15 minutes, so we probably should start and begin this process. We're here to talk about smart home technologies for the cognitively impaired. And over the next 75 minutes, what we hope to do is offer you a snapshot of the emerging wave of technologies that are available to help people in their home and work environments function better using assistive technology. Our panel originally, if you look at the flyer, originally was going to be had two other members. Unfortunately, Jesus Favela from Mexico and Catherine Gianola from the Veterans Administration were not able to attend for personal reasons. I'm very sorry about that. We were hoping to have a multinational panel, and that didn't happen this year. That said, those of you who are RESNA members know the members of this panel very well. For the past decade and maybe more, this group has held leadership positions at RESNA and has helped organization grow. So I'm very happy to be able to stand up here with them. What I'd like to do is just go through an introduction of each of them, and then one by one we'll give our talk. And my hope is that there'll be 10 or 15 minutes at the end of this talk where we can have a discussion around these kinds of things. A lot of the talk today is going to be about emerging research, products that are not yet on the market, but they're products that may be on the market in the future, to give you an idea of what the directions are among these three laboratories. And what I'll be talking about in just a minute is products that are on the market already that can be used as smart home technologies. So first let me just talk for a moment. Kathy Bodine, I'm sure most of you know her. By trade, she's a speech and language pathologist who's been working in assistive technology since 1985. She's an associate professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehab and Pediatrics at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center. And she's also the executive director of Assistive Technology Partners. Among all of her many other responsibilities, which would take 75 minutes to describe, she's the principal investigator for the RERC for Advancing Cognitive Technologies at the University of Colorado. And she'll be talking about three projects at the RERC that involve smart home technologies. Ed Lopresti in the middle here is an inventor, accomplished inventor and engineer. He's the president of AT Sciences, LLC in Pittsburgh. He conducts research and development on task guidance software for people with cognitive impairments and on intelligent mobility aids. He participates with the RERC that Kathy runs and also with the RERC on telerehabilitation and research projects. And he'll be talking about queuing systems that also have telerehabilitation features. At the very end, Alex Mihalaitis is an engineer at the University of Toronto, where he works in, he's an assistant professor in the Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy there. He's been working for many years and developing products and interventions and solutions for people in the areas of elder care and wellness, technology for children with autism, and adaptive tools for nurses and clinical applications. He holds a number of currently funded research grants and is published widely. He'll be talking about two of his current projects. One of them is a prompting system that can be used in the home, and the other is a system that helps people detect the possibility for a person falling in the home. That said, let me just introduce myself for a second. My name is Tony Gentry. I'm an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, where I run the Assistive Technology for Cognition Laboratory. Most of my research in the last 10 years or so has been looking at the functional implications of the use of handheld computers for people with brain injury, autism, or multiple sclerosis. And I'm currently launching a project with the Department of Rehab Services here in Virginia, where we're setting up a model demo home, smart home, using off-the-shelf technologies to see how they can help people with brain injuries function better. So this is our panel, and I'll start. Current uses for individuals with cognitive impairment. First question you might ask coming in here is, who needs a smart home? And those of us in the choir here in the room probably understand. People with mobility limitations have been using smart home technologies for many years. People with attention, memory, and other cognitive problems can use smart home technologies. This is sort of an emerging idea. That's why we're having this panel today, to sort of throw this idea out there. People who have medical care needs that are not being addressed by at-home or live-in caregivers, who may be at risk for nursing home placement. And finally, and this is very important, among any of the people in those populations, people need to be motivated to increase their independence through the use of AT. And the reason I'm saying that is there are a lot of people out there who would much prefer to have a living human being caregiver in the home than have some robot tell them what to do. And there's an issue around that that all of us in the AT world have been addressing and will continue to address. So why smart homes? People spend most of their time at home. Homes can be hazardous for people with cognitive impairment. I've primarily worked in the brain injury community most of my life, and I've had a couple clients in that time who've burned their homes down because they left pans frying on the front on the stove. People have also had to completely repair their homes because they flooded them. They left the bathtub on, went in and watched the Super Bowl, and came back, and their entire house was flooded. Those are the kinds of things that people with cognitive impairments can run into in a home setting. Home care is expensive and often unavailable, as we all know. Any of us who have elderly parents know that. And homes can act as cognitive aids to get things done better, faster, and safer. Typically, there are two approaches that have been used in smart home technologies. One is a passive approach, and the other is a what you might call a responsive approach. The passive approach uses techniques along the column here on the left, basic safety devices, EADL devices. You may think of something such as automatic bill paying as a smart home technology, automatic grocery delivery, which allows so that you have a weekly delivery of your groceries without having to go to the grocery store, automated queuing, which can be done through a PC, and different devices that can be used as medication managers. The responsive systems, a lot of which are going to be talked about today, especially the cutting edge responsive systems, are sensor-based or video-based. And the ones that are on the market today, we'll talk about them in just a minute, a lot of them have to do with linking you to your doctor so the doctor can keep track of your vitals, things like blood sugar and blood pressure and that sort of thing. And also the idea of having links to your family so that there's some kind of a pager that connects you to your family and checks in with you from time to time to see how you're doing. There's also an emerging, huge emerging field in the telecare community that I think is going to continue to grow. So just to give you a quick idea, some devices that you can pick up and use as smart home technologies off the shelf. Here's a stovetop monitor that costs about $150. This monitor has an electronic eye that reads, that keeps track of the kitchen. It tracks the kitchen. It's connected to your stove. And if it notices that no one has been in the kitchen for a period of time, say 30 minutes, it turns the stove off. Here's a device that many of us have seen. For about $1, you can buy this at Lowe's. You stick the faucet will not run unless your finger's stuck in the faucet, so it keeps you from flooding your house. You have to be there in order for the water to run. Other devices, this is an alarm system. It costs about $25 that you can put in your bathtub. This one's connected next to the toilet. If the water level reaches that alarm, the alarm goes off and says, come in here and help me. We're flooding. Universal design principles, just having an electric light that turns on and off when you come in and out of the house can be a huge help for people with cognitive impairment, especially for the elderly and people with vision difficulties, because having light is helpful. This is a window. This is the most expensive thing I'm going to show you that turns into a door so people can escape the first floor if they need to and can't get to the door. And finally, we all know about medic alert bracelets, which are probably the most heavily used smart home technology or assistive technology for cognition on the market today. And I also added at the bottom, again, the automated bill paying. And I'm a big fan of this idea as a smart home technology because I've had a couple clients over the years who lost their homes because they forgot to pay their rent or they forgot to pay their mortgage. It's not that they didn't have the money. The bill just didn't happen to go out. Resident members are very familiar with EADL devices. X10 is the old standby, and there's the Insteon system, which can be wired or wireless, is another great system, typically used for people with spinal cord injury or other mobility limitations, but they can also be used as cognitive aids. If you think of a home that turns itself on in the morning, the lights come on, music starts playing, maybe a queuing prompt comes on in the bathroom to show you how to brush your teeth. Those are kinds of things that can be set up using X10 or Insteon systems, and they can have the house actually be a sort of living brain for a person. Prompts and reminders that are computerized, as we all know, Microsoft Outlook, AbleLink Schedule, Impact is a new simplified system by the AbleLink company. On Mac, the Apple iCal is a good calendar and prompt system. And all of those software, all that information on those prompting systems can be sent down to your PDA when you go out into the community. There's a company called ePill.com, and if you don't know about them, definitely check out their website. That's a terrific site that sells products that are used for medication management and also different kinds of reminder systems. You're looking at the top-of-the-line product. It's called the MD2. The MD2 stacks tons of medicine, tons of pills up inside this box. It's about this big, and it sits on your kitchen counter. And in whatever voice you programmed, your daughter's or your own, it tells you it's time to take your medicine. The medicine then pops down through this slot and waits for you. If you don't take the medicine out of the slot after a period of, say, 10 minutes, it calls or emails your loved one to say mom hasn't taken her pill. So that's a product that costs about $400, not that expensive, and is a sort of passive monitoring system as well as a medication dispenser. Paging systems can be used a lot of different ways. These are just any pager you might have to keep track of people at home. And there are creative ways that you can do that to help people keep track of your safety, fall checks, connections with the family, paying bills, and that sort of thing. And any of us in this room who are occupational therapists are very, very familiar with the idea of low tech in cognitive aids. And I'm a big fan of having an uncluttered home as the best smart home you can have. A lot of my clients spend all day looking for their car keys, and that's a bad way to spend your time. So you can have an OT or some other healthcare provider come in and provide suggestions for making your home safer and less cluttered so you don't have to spend all day looking for your car keys. These things can also be taken out into the community. That's the Jitterbug phone, which is the simplest phone on the market, a terrific product for people with cognitive disability who get lost in the interface of your everyday cell phone. They're portable pill boxes that can be used as reminder systems. And on the corner there, to my left, your right, is basically a $100 software that allows you to connect remotely to your X10 products in your home, and so that a caregiver can actually do the programming for a smart home at an extended location. There's a gentleman in England named Guy Dewsbury who's been working in this area for a long time, and I put his website, linked to it at the end of the resource list. He's looked at some of the issues that we're all facing in looking at smart home technologies, and the things that he most thinks are important, and those of us in AT understand these in other areas of AT: fitness for purpose, acceptability, trustworthiness, and adaptability. And you can summarize all those things in some of the research that's been done around these issues. AT in general and smart home technology has to be transparent. It has to benefit you more than the hassle in using it is involved. I wear my glasses because I need to be able to see, and the hassle of cleaning them and finding them and wearing them is less than the benefit I get from using them. Same thing for a smart home technology. People don't like things that are too weird, too Star Trek-y, or too geeky. So if it looks more like something else I have in the house, I'll be more likely to use it. And that issue is huge for people who are using AT. People will use exactly what they need and no more. So over-engineering a house is a good way to have a person not use what you're recommending. And then finally, people are willing to pay money as long as the top four things have been addressed. And this is, all of us probably know this, what we know about AT use in general. Quickly, active monitoring systems. I just want to talk about this for a minute. Traditionally, what we thought of as an active monitoring system is a video camera that watches you. And at some remote site, someone watches the video camera to see that you're okay. There are a lot of nursing homes in the U.S. today that are set up that way with panels of video monitors at the nursing station. That's a scary thought to me and probably to you, but that's how things are being done in these virtual nursing homes. There's some companies out there that can do that in your home for you. Rest Assured in Lafayette, Indiana, and Sound Response Night Owl in Madison, Wisconsin do that sort of thing. They'll set up video systems that observe you in the home. At a remote site, someone's watching that, and if something goes wrong, they'll send someone to help you. There's some issues with that, as you can imagine. Privacy needs of users. Does the person want to have a camera watching them, or would they prefer having a human being there? Systems that use robotic monitors, so far we're finding they're fairly inflexible, so they might be unsafe. They may not pick up that you fell. They may think something else has happened, for instance. Question that we all have to think about if we're going to buy a product like this is, who's going to respond, how long is it going to take them to get there, and what are they going to do when they get there? What's going to be monitored? A lot of people don't want to have their bathroom or their bedroom monitored for obvious reasons, and those are the most likely places that you're going to get yourself hurt if you're at home. What happens if the power goes out? And questions we're going to have to ask, and I hope this discussion today will generate some questions around that. When is a passive system better than an active system, and vice versa? One quick thing about the responder issue, just look at these things for a minute. Response times are not good for most systems that are in place today. MedAlert calls are 90% false alarms, and the typical response time for any medical alert call is 30 minutes. So when you're thinking about using a product like this, you have to think about who's going to be responding on the other end. This is just, I just want to touch on one issue around these ideas. Finally, I just want to say we need all of you to help. If you're working with Smart Home Solutions, if you've already tried this, it's working or not working for you, please contact me. I'm the chair of the SIG20 here. I'd love for you to talk with me about it, and we can begin to share these ideas on the web or in conference or just in discussions. Yes, this is my email. If you need a handout from today, write this down and email me. And if you have information you want to share with me about smart home technology or with the rest of the panel, please contact me there as well. Okay? Thank you. These are some websites. I just want to show you one quick one. This is a company called homemods.org. They have a terrific continuing education online course for helping people learn how to modify their homes for people with dementia or cognitive impairment. I can just say it, logentry at v as in Victor, cu.edu. You know what? I'll put it up again at the end if that's okay. Thanks, Kath.
Okay, can everybody hear me?
You need the mic.
Okay, can everybody hear me pretty well? Good morning. Thank you for coming. Before I get started, I would like to acknowledge some of my colleagues that are here this morning. Dr. Michael Leitner, University of Colorado Boulder, very important person. Michael is a co-PI on our RERC-ACT, and Dr. Clayton Lewis, who's hiding in the back, who's also one of my colleagues along with Ed on our RERC. These guys are real engineers. I just heard cats or heard engineers. So if you have technical questions, I'm sure they'll be thrilled to speak with you when we're finished. But these guys have just been fantastic to work with. So I'm going to, like Tony, we'll move quickly so we have some time at the end and also give my colleagues some additional time. I'm going to talk a little bit about the prevalence of cognitive disability in the U.S., just to give us a big overview. We're going to talk about some projects. One was the evaluation of remote support architecture, a battery-less power source, and remote communication support. So these are pieces that might be of value for folks who are interested in smart home technologies. And I think it's real important to kind of give you a little landscape. Our RERC is organized around the principles of thinking about existing, emerging, and new technologies for people with cognitive disabilities. And this is kind of a nice look at that model as we talk today. So I want to talk about smart home technology, and this says a plugger upgrades her memory by buying larger Post-its. And my point with this cartoon is that sometimes low-tech or no-tech can be the smartest solution you can come up with, and I always like to keep that in mind because, as Tony said, you know, high-tech sometimes, stuff that's too weird is a bit much, and so we always like to start with the least obtrusive and the least intrusive strategy that we can come up with. When we think about the prevalence of cognitive disability, this is from numbers from 2006. We have currently over 22.24 million persons with some type of cognitive disability living in the United States alone. That does not include Canada. That does not include the rest of the world. About 29% have severe persistent mental illness, 27% traumatic brain injury, 21% intellectual disabilities, 19% Alzheimer's, 4% stroke, and so as you can see, there is not only a lot of people with cognitive disabilities, but there is a plethora of cognitive disabilities in different areas, and many of these people have very specific or different needs from other types of cognitive disabilities. So it's something for us all to think about. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do is review a little project. If you stopped by our RERC booth and got the packet, there are two papers in that packet. There's a paper from our cognitive leaders research team as well as from Regan Zane, another project I'm going to talk about today. If you didn't get that and you want to give me your email, we'll be glad to get that information out to you in just a bit. Our cognitive leaders research team is out of the University of Colorado Boulder and led by Jim Sullivan, and he has a very nice crew of folks. And basically, what these guys were doing is they wanted to really understand what is going on for people with developmental disabilities who are trying to live independently, and what are the areas and issues around places where you can get into trouble, how should we prompt people, and what's the most effective strategy to use for that. So what they did is basically they did an ethnography-based design, and they evaluation assessment methodology really allowed them to explore some different models for community living for people with these disabilities. And they ended up designing and developing and actually evaluating an architecture that supported people with these disabilities, and they wanted to look at something pretty complex. So they looked at an everyday task, cooking. And if you think about cooking, that is one of the most complex things that you can do in your home, and they really wanted to see what's going on and where do people have breakdowns and what's the best way to support them. And so what they basically did is they created a multimedia prompting system, and it was really cool. When you saw the setup, they basically had remote chat and video communication technologies. They also had a synchronized caregiver support console that had an event log, so they kind of knew what was going on, when it was happening, and what they needed to do. And what was nice is they had an on-demand, secure video chat with a caregiver, in this case, a colleague of ours, Anya, who was able to, when someone got into trouble, they could touch the kiosk and they could have access to a live human being to respond to them and to provide the prompts they need. And so this lovely graphic basically was a problem detection graphic that they came up with, and I won't go into all the details, but the idea was when a problem is detected, what is the problem, first of all, how did we detect there was a problem, and what are we going to do about it, and what's the best solution for that problem? What they saw, and this is something that I think as we look into this, we kind of all, you know, when you think about task prompting, we kind of all know, we think, what the steps are and where somebody might get in trouble, and we try to anticipate this. What they discovered were a tremendous number of unanticipated episodes that really required outside assistance, and things like finding the pan that is not put away in the right spot, and that could be a horrendous issue for someone who's trying to cook and they have an intellectual disability. The need for improvisation, if you didn't have Crisco shortening, then what? What are you going to do? And thinking through, that's complex cognitive stuff, trying to figure that out. And completing subtasks within a complex step, that could be very difficult for these folks. And even though problems did occur, most of the time, with one exception, they were able to get meals successfully prepared. We have this little bug up here, so if you see me doing this, it's I'm not having a seizure. What they discovered was that there were several task prompting sequences that could be reused with minimal modifications. And they also said that when they talked with the caregivers, these technology supports really did provide some means for independence, even in supervised settings. So when you had a live-in caregiver there, this was still useful technology for folks to use. And it was gave individuals with cognitive disabilities the ability to do things at their own pace and in their own way. And that helped shift the caregiver from do this, do this, do this, to more of a coaching role. And that's really important. And that is one of those substeps in making someone have that independence. And they also talked about that they learned very clearly that having remote assistance is not the same as on-site assistance. And I think that's really important because a lot of times when we do usability tests, we're there on-site doing this. This is not the same thing, and this is an important point that they did learn. You know, caregivers can't always discern the problem from simple communication with the resident. And just talking to somebody, even if you can see their face, doesn't mean that you're going to know exactly what's really going on. And the things that were viewed as most powerful were the face-to-face video chat with the resident and the environmental cameras, where they could see what was going on in the environment. Least useful were the event logs on the computer. That really didn't tell them anything they needed to know. And then the other thing, of course, is if the house is on fire and you're not there to smell it, you don't know what's happening. And if someone can't articulate that to you, that's another issue with remote support. And also, when it was really kind of fun to talk to them, being able to really, really set up the camera so that you can see everything. You know, if a cabinet door opens and your camera view is blocked even a little bit, then that remote support becomes very difficult. So when we're instrumenting these smart homes, it's really, really not as easy as it might sound to do. And of course, the need for very high quality communication technology. So I think that was one of the things I loved about this study, is that they really learned a lot of things that most, quote, engineers might not pick up on. Most clinicians may not understand they need to communicate to engineers who are really trying to put these things together. So it was a really nice complementary piece. Now, the next project I'm going to talk about is one we're really excited about. It's the Batteryless Micropower Sensors for Context-Aware Technologies. Dr. Regan Zane, his students, Dr. Zoya Popovich, have been working on this for quite some time. It's very exciting. Mike brought a demo unit that TSA, I understand, really took a close look at, and he's been cobbling it back together ever since he got here. So talk to Mike about this project. But basically what they're looking at, two main goals. They want to reduce the level of maintenance of electronics that support smart homes and health monitoring technologies. And the classic example that I use is that if you have a pacemaker installed from a healthcare perspective, guess what happens after 12 or 15 years? You have to have a second surgery to replace the battery. It'd be kind of nice if we didn't have to do that. So kind of a long-range thinking and goal. And the other idea is to produce sensors that do not use batteries and are not connected by a wire to any external source of power, thus a batteryless power source. And so what has been coming out of this, they have a couple sequential major outputs. First of all, a wireless smart home sensor that was built from a combination of discrete and custom components, and this wireless health monitor patch that's built using primarily custom components for miniaturization. The idea, we all know how much batteries weigh, and we all know how big some of this stuff can be. So really thinking about how can we also miniaturize these ideas. And so basically, and as Regan puts it, there's a whole bunch of acronyms that they go through and a bunch of math, and then at the end, they come up with this powerless source. So looking at ambient power and power processing techniques that are important. And so this is his nice description of how this all goes together for those of you that are engineers. And basically, this is looking at the envisioned prototype and how this is all going to work with the technology that they pulled together. So now get it to something that makes sense to me. What we're looking at is a tech transfer project right now. What has been really cool is you'll notice we have a switch that is not connected by a wire to this happens to be the chat box. And basically, we were able to harvest enough energy from the ambient energy that's around that we no longer need a battery placed to operate this wireless switch. We think this is something that's very critically important for the field of assistive technology and certainly nice proof of concept for some future smart home technologies. And basically, it's non-invasive, low power, low energy. We don't have to do anything. And, of course, knowing our populations, we don't have to fumble with chargers and batteries and all those other things. So we're very excited about this product. We'll keep you posted on how that goes in the next year or so as we move forward with some of the AT companies that are planning to transfer this into their products. And finally, I want to talk about a project that I work most directly with is the technology for remote family support for people with cognitive disabilities. And my buddy Clayton in the back of the room is also working on this project. And basically, what we're looking at, and to put it in a nutshell, is we're looking at the notion of social isolation and people, particularly elders with early onset Alzheimer's or other dementias, who are trying to live at home, trying to maintain independence, but typically, and in my case, I'm a classic example, I live 1,000 miles away from my parents. And so that social communication, that social networking, and that need to communicate with folks at a distance. And these are people that typically aren't computer users. So this generation, we have some real interesting things with our elders not using computers. So what Dr. Michael Williams and his team have developed is something called the digital mailbox. And what's really cool about it is on our end, on the family or caregiver end, we have a secure website that cannot be spammed and cannot have all kinds of other things added to it, where we can set up mail for our elders. And I'll talk about my family in particular. I have an uncle in Italy, I have a sister in California, I have a cousin in Texas, et cetera, et cetera. We all have access to this website. We can set up emails for delivery anytime we want. There's also included all kinds of ready-mades, or crossword puzzles, cards, all kinds of cool things that we can use. And we can set these up for delivery. My parents' home, 7 a.m. every morning, they have a little HP scanner basically set up. It has one button on it. And every morning, automatically at 7 a.m., the mail comes. And they get a hard copy color printout of our electronic communication. Okay, so what? The so what is, what's really cool about it is they can write back in pen and paper. They can lay it on the scanner, press one button, and it comes back to me electronically. So I can be anywhere in the world, and my parents can communicate with me, I can communicate with them, and that's kind of how the system works. And so as you can see, you can send pictures, all kinds of things back and forth. They can do the same. They can lay a photo on the scanner, press that one button. They don't have to know how it works. They just know they have one button and they can send me stuff, and for all I know, they think I get a piece of paper on my end. But it works out very, very well. You can automate your delivery, you can set things up, so I can be anywhere in the world, and I've got stuff I know my parents are going to hear from me on a daily basis or every other day or whatever. So our study has been looking at this notion of, can we assist people who are living, trying to live independently, can we reduce the social isolation, number one, and number two, does this long-term lead for the ability for them to stay in their home? Because they're more engaged, they're more interested, they're more apt to pay attention. So as you can see, there's lots and lots of things that they provide that are already there, easy for us to put together, and we can get out to the family. And the idea is leading to personal wellness and engageability. Now, there's all kinds of other iterations that Caring Family has gone into with assisted living centers and kiosks and things like that that aren't a topic for today. But I think it's really a very interesting technology. It's very, very simple. And for a lot of elders who aren't used to using, or people with cognitive disabilities who are not computer users, this is one way to really enhance that communication. So I want to acknowledge my RERC team members, along with the ones that aren't here today. We have an incredible group of folks across the United States that are working with us, and of course our funding provided by NIDER and the Coleman Institute for Cognitive Disabilities.
Good morning again. My name is Edmund Lopresti, and I'll be talking about a product that's under development with my company, AT Sciences, and a number of colleagues that I'll squeeze onto the last slide. But what I'll be talking about is an interactive task guidance system and looking at providing it with physical and social context in a smart home setting. But as far as the basic system, interactive task guidance, we're looking at something that can prompt people through step-by-step tasks, whether it's activities of daily living or vocational tasks or other sorts of tasks, something that's interactive where if something goes that's not quite according to the most typical plan, the system can adjust either to adjust the steps in the task or to reschedule tasks on the person's schedule. And I'll be talking primarily about applications for people with cognitive impairments, although some of the things that I'll be talking about would also have applications for people with physical, sensory, or other impairments. So the basic system that we're working on we call IQ, and the primary goal, of course, is to assist people with disabilities, particularly cognitive impairments, to be more independent in their daily tasks. But we also want to support keeping the person connected with their clinicians and their caregivers. So we want to support the rehabilitation professional in defining the person's tasks and getting feedback on how they're responding to cues, which might impact how the therapist wants to structure their cues or other aspects of their treatment, and then also their day-to-day caregiver, whether it's a paraprofessional, a family member living with the client, or a family member who may be remote from the client, and helping them to manage the person's day-to-day schedule, get some feedback on sort of the general well-being and activity of the client, and also real-time alerts if something happens that IQ is not able to automatically adapt to. So the system starts out with a task being defined. All the tasks are ultimately defined by a therapist or the caregiver, so a big part of the task is supporting the therapist in developing these tasks. There might be some library of task templates that the therapist can draw from, but we want to make it easy for the occasions when these tasks have to be adapted for the unique needs of a particular client, or a particular unique task needs to be created from scratch by a therapist or a family member who may not be the most computer proficient person, but is the person who knows what that client needs. Once a task is defined, it gets sent over the internet to kind of the central part of IQ, which we call the cognition manager. The cognition manager keeps track of the person's schedule, and when the time comes when a task needs to become active, it sends out information over the internet to what we call the activity assistant, which would be a piece of software that's on the client's PDA, smartphone, laptop or desktop computer, whatever it might be, that's going to actually deliver the cues. And then the person gets the text prompts, voice prompts, pictures, or whatever the therapist or family member has set up to give the person their reminders and their task guidance. The person then sends back their acknowledgments. They push a button when the step is done, or they push a button if they need some assistance, or the information that time has elapsed without any response. And then either the cognition manager uses that to adapt to the task. The person's done, we'll go to the next step, or something has not been done in the right amount of time, we'll see if they need some help. And then the cognition manager can also send that information along to the family member or therapist, either to indicate that someone could check at the end of the day, they did all of these tasks, but this task they seem to have some trouble with. Or in the case of something that happens that the IQ cannot automatically deal with, the family member or the therapist might get a real-time alert that something seems to have gone wrong. So all that is a bit of introduction to actually getting into some of the smart home applications. So what we're looking at, as I mentioned, right now the information that the system has to decide when to deliver a task is just what time it is. It's 2 o'clock, it's time for your doctor's appointment, or it's 5 o'clock, it's time to start getting dinner ready. And the information it gets back is either that the person's pressed a button on the on their PDA, or that a certain amount of time has gone by without that happening. So what we're looking at is ways in a smart home setting to provide some social context for behavioral cueing, or some physical context from sensors that are in the environment. So the first application is behavioral cueing, and behavioral cueing doesn't require smart home technology. It's typically provided, it can be provided with a standard PDA, or you may be familiar with a device called the WatchMinder, which is designed to provide these sorts of cues. And the idea is that with a cognitive impairment, someone might have impulse control impairment or other functional impairments that cause them to have some behavioral issues that might be socially inappropriate or might even be dangerous to the individual. And you provide them with occasional cues at regular intervals to pay attention, to relax, to speak more often, to speak less often, depending on what the issues might be. Where we're looking to take that a step further is we believe that the same behaviors that are inappropriate in one setting may not be a problem in another setting, or might have different issues in a different context, whether the person's at work or at home, whether they're with family members or friends, or whether they're in a group therapy session. So you might want to vary those behavioral cues based on the person's social context. So what we're looking at is being able to label, you know, being able to define a number of behavioral cues, the ones you want the person to get at work or the ones you want them to get when they're, you know, out having a beer with friends. And then to be able to provide a little tag to the tasks in the person's schedule, where if they're doing these tasks, they're probably in a work setting. If they're doing these tasks, they're probably with friends, or if these tasks indicate that they're probably at home, so that the person's only getting the correct behavioral cues that will help them to be socially appropriate in the setting they're in, or help them to be safe in the in their current environment. And that's a task that we're working on with the RERC on cognitive assistive technology. And then another direction that we're looking at in a sort of more traditional way of looking at smart homes is getting sensor information about a person's physical context, you know, what's actually happening in the home. And this allows us to provide prompts that are relevant to the current situation. For example, you know, right now we rely on the person to press buttons when they're done with a step, but you know, have they really turned off the oven, or have they really taken their medication, or are they just hitting that button? With sensors in the environment, you can get some of that information on what's really happening. On the other hand, maybe the person is a little more independent. They've already done what they need to do. You don't need to be nagging them with some automated reminders. And if you have sensors, you can detect that and save them getting annoyed with unnecessary reminders. And finally, you can, along with that, you can detect safety risks, and that might trigger a task. If you notice that the oven has been on for an hour for no obvious reason, you can initiate a task reminding the person to go to the kitchen and turn off the oven. And if that fails, you can take action, either automatically turn off the oven if you have that capability, or alert a caregiver that they might need to call the person or come in person and check on the situation. So we've done a few different projects that use sensors in different ways. We've worked with folks at University of Pittsburgh and Utah State University on a walker that can detect where you are in a building and give you wayfinding cues. So based on your location, it can give you step-by-step instructions to get to the destination. And that would use RFID tags around the house, or could use other ways of detecting your location. With some folks at University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University, we're working on a system where a person wears some accelerometer sensors that can detect their movements and interpret those as subtasks in a larger task. In this case, it's working as a fry cook in a vocational setting. Are they putting things on the grill? Are they flipping them? Are they taking them off the grill? And then to be able to give them task-related cues only when they need them, if we detect an error or if we detect that they haven't done anything for a while, you know, prompt them along. And also some pilot work in monitoring safety at the Blue Roof Technology Smart Cottage, which is in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. And they have a a smart home that uses some traditional off-the-shelf technologies, some of the things that Tony talked about at the beginning of the session. And we're working on integrating those into a way of logging all that information and providing it to caregivers and ultimately to our system for providing prompts. So those have all been isolated projects that we've been working on. A recent project that we're just starting up is to try to develop a flexible sensor network where we can integrate arbitrary sensors, you know, some extend devices, some motion detectors, some newer things like RFID tags, by having little piece of software that goes along with the sensor and translates that particular sensor's input into something that IQ can understand and then can use in the task prompts. And then also providing that information for the caregiver in designing a task, how to make available to the caregiver that not only can they give the person a prompt and wait for a button, but also tie in maybe this task, this step really relies on the oven getting turned on, or this step relies on the water getting turned off, and how to provide that information to the caregiver without overwhelming the caregiver with too many options in their user interface. So I've talked about a number of related projects with a number of collaborators at the University of Michigan, University of Pittsburgh, Track Labs in Houston, the Institute for Matching Person and Technologies, Blue Roof Technologies, I mentioned, Carnegie Mellon and Utah State University, the RERCs on advancing cognitive technology and telerehabilitation, as well as SBIR support from the NIH and DARPA. So I thank all of my collaborators, and thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your discussion after at the end of the session.
Okay, now? All right. I'll tangle up here. Okay, so what I want to do right now and just kind of finish up with, I think probably some of the systems that Tony's referring to when he's talking about the nerdy Star Trek systems, even though I've never seen an episode of Star Trek my whole life, so I swear on that one. So what I want to talk to you is really some of the work that we're doing back at the University of Toronto and Toronto Rehab Institute on intelligent systems to support wellness and health among older adults. And I'm talking primarily about older adults with a cognitive impairment such as dementia or Alzheimer's disease at this point. And really, the overall vision, the goal of the research that we do is to develop new and innovative intelligent systems and devices to support not the only older adults in the home, but also their caregivers as well. Now, when I talk about intelligent systems, I'm talking about technologies that can essentially use artificial intelligence and various advanced computer science techniques to learn about the person, adapt automatically, and essentially do whatever the person needs to be done. So our overall vision is a system that you turn on and you walk away from it. It does everything else. It customizes itself. It learns about the person. It learns about the different activities that the person wants to do, the preferences, the abilities, the disabilities, whatever piece of context is important, these systems will learn and integrate itself. So kind of the picture I use is kind of this overall sense of this intelligent home, which essentially, no matter what you're doing, understands your context and provides assistance no matter what. So for example, it may understand that I'm trying to wash my hands, use the toilet, I've forgotten what step to do, it gives me that reminder. It may realize it's time for medication, again, give me the reminder to do so. More importantly, it may understand the context of where I am. It may realize I'm downstairs in the basement performing a task, and the prompt would actually come on in the basement as opposed to just the machine beeping up in the washroom and me not hearing it. It may detect that I've fallen and try to call for help automatically. And again, these are systems where there's no sensor worn on the person, everything is built into the environment. Or the house itself and the system may just realize I'm having a bad day. I'm moving more slowly today, I'm, you know, not quite myself, and it may just ask me, are you feeling okay? Do you want me to call for someone to check in on you? Do you want to talk to someone? Do you want me to call your son, your daughter, your caregiver, whoever else? So what I want to do just for the rest of this presentation is really just show you some examples of some specific systems, and I'm going to have no words on these slides after this one, I promise. They're all just going to be pictures and videos of these technologies actually working with real people and real clients. So the first system I want to talk to you about is called the Coach, and this is our prompting system similar to what Ed was talking about with his system, where the system can track a user through common activities they live in and provide cues and reminders when necessary. Now, our systems are really being developed for any type of ADL, anything where there's a sequence of steps that needs to be completed, it can be used for. But our kind of representative task at this point is always being hand washing. And the reason why we do hand washing is because when you talk to any family caregiver and you ask them, okay, where is the place where care typically breaks down? At what point do you get so stressed out that the person is removed and put into the long-term care home, they always say it's in the washroom, it's toileting. It's these private ADLs, which is always the breakdown. Now, toileting is a very complicated, very hazardous task for us to be developing new technologies for, but we still want to stay in that context, so we use hand washing instead at this stage. So very quickly, the way the system works is it uses a webcam. Now, all of our sensing is based on computer vision. Now, this is not the computer, the video cameras that Tony was talking about before, where there's a human operator somewhere else watching it. This is computer vision. The system takes an image, analyzes it, gets the required data, makes a decision, then dumps the image itself. So there's no privacy issue here. Essentially, what we're developing and working with is a more complex motion sensor. Now, the reason why we do computer vision is twofold. One, from one sensor, we can get a lot of different information. So for all these different systems I'm talking about, we can just use the one camera to get all the information as opposed to having a wide variety of different sensors and different types of networks. And two, there's a lot of other research going on in RFID, motion sensors, et cetera. So we're going to focus our effort on computer vision, which at some point most likely we're looking at hybrid systems, a combination of all these different sensor types that we're all working on. So we have the camera. What the camera does is tracks the motion of the person. So for example, in hand washing, we may track hand location, and I'll show you this working. In the particular context of hand washing, the tracking system takes the hand and the towel position, so not only are we tracking the person, but we're tracking the objects being used as well. We know where the towel is, we know where the soap is, et cetera. We then go into our artificial intelligence engine, which essentially is something called Belief Monitor, which takes all this data and decides, okay, this is what I think the person is doing. This is the type of information that's required, and this is the type of assistance that may be needed for the person to get to the next step. Now, the one thing I want to mention is all of our technologies are passive. If you walk in and you can wash your hands, you can use the toilet, it looks like a regular washroom, it's silent. It's only when you make an error does the system actually do something. Okay? Same thing with all the other technologies I'm going to show you. At this point, if the system decides, okay, a prompt is required, the person has missed a step, they've done something out of sequence, et cetera, then a prompt is provided. Now, the prompt can vary in terms of detail and the type depending on the person. So it may learn for one particular type of person that a general cue is all that's needed. For example, dry your hands. As opposed to someone else, they may need far more detail, a video modeling how to use the towel or how to turn on the tap, being addressed by name perhaps to get their attention. So again, these are all the different facets that the system, the AI, learns about each person and adapts accordingly. Now I'm going to try to use this microphone. Just to show a video here.
Oh, you're doing great.
Thank you.
Put the knobs to turn the water off.
All right, yes.
Okay, so that was just an example of a clip taken from one of our clinical trials. So we've actually tested the coach in four different sets of trials in various nursing homes around Toronto. And what that clip shows is a couple of examples of the way the system is working. So what happened there is the system detected that she was kind of stalling on a task. She was sitting there, she was kind of playing with the water, not doing the next thing. So at that point, decided, okay, well, we need to prompt her now because she's taking too long in this particular step, as she typically does. Now, the system's already learned in the from the past trials with her, or the past usages, that she always requires that video prompt. So you saw the video coming on demonstrating to her how to turn the water on. It's also learned that she needs to be addressed by name to get her attention. Now, the other interesting thing that we saw with particular her is that she interacted with the system. She interacted with it like it would be a caregiver standing next to her, and she actually started having conversations with the system as well. Now, this has kind of led us down to our next part of this research project, where we're trying to make this a more natural dialogue that the person has. So this is going to include the inclusion of speech recognition and some other dialogue management systems that we take out of the computer science world so that the system can recognize, okay, she perhaps has responded back, and then the system will respond back with an appropriate prompt or just a general piece of conversation if needed. So that was the coach. Our next system is called the helper, and this is our fall detection emergency response system. And again, so this is that whole issue of monitoring a person in their home for safety. Now, this project started in cooperation with Lifeline. Everyone knows Lifeline. They have the push-button systems. And basically, how this started is Lifeline came and said, Alex, we are the first ones to admit that our products do not work. 70% of those people who use our product forget to wear the push button. 80% of those people who wear the push button never push it because they may not want to call someone for help, or they may be unconscious or seriously injured. So they came to us and they said, is there any way we can use some of your environmental sensing, the computer vision, to make a hands-free emergency response system? That's what this project here is. So again, same kind of diagram as before. We use a small video camera. So this is just based on a webcam. You know, it's $40 from your Staples or, you know, your ever whatever shop you buy your electronics here in the U.S. It's different in Canada. Small video camera that tracks the movements of the person. And then looks at two different things. So it looks at the location, the occupant determines, okay, has the person fallen or not? And this is based on very simple posture analysis that we do with the system. So the system can automatically detect if the person is standing up, if they're sprawled out, if they're leaning over to tie their shoe. Okay, so three very different postures that we use. What it then does is then does two things. It kind of looks at the spontaneous event. So has the person fallen? If so, let's have a conversation with the person and call for help if needed, as you'll see in the video. But it also does this long-term behavior analysis as well. So over time, by watching the person, we can actually build an automated schedule of what the person does. The system learns automatically how often do they go to the bathroom, when do they typically sleep, when do they leave their house, etc. And based on this, it looks for deviations and changes. So if the system all of a sudden sees that the person is going to the washroom twice as many times than they typically do, this may raise an alert to their caregiver, their family member, etc., just to check in on the person to make sure they're okay. So the video I'm going to show now is actually of the fall detection system, which is here. So what you see on the far is the scene camera, and then the two are the views from the webcams and the tracking of the person.
Hello, Mr. Smith. This is your automated health monitoring system. Do you need help? Please say yes or no.
Yes.
Would you like me to call an ambulance? Please say yes or no.
No.
Would you like me to call someone else to help you? Please say yes or no.
Yes.
There are two people on your contact list, your daughter Anne and your neighbor Paul. Would you like me to call your daughter Anne? Please say yes or no.
No.
Then I will call your neighbor Paul instead. Please say yes to confirm. Or no to be connected to an operator.
Yes.
I am calling your neighbor Paul now. Please wait, Mr. Smith. I will give you an update momentarily.
Okay, so that's an example of one of the versions of the prototype. And obviously, there's certain limitations here. Healthy young adult, clear voice. He's not injured, obviously. So some of the new work we're actually doing now in this system is actually developing the speech recognition component for older adults, particularly who may be injured. So this is a very different data set that currently exists in the speech recognition world. So what we're actually doing is having to develop our own speech database. So we're having older adult actors come in who are going to pretend to be injured, pretend to have the muffled voice, be in distress, and they're going to be recording various sentences and sounds that we're going to be putting in the database to redevelop the speech recognition system. And the hope of developing this database, not only for our own development, but to make this database and publicly available to other people working in this field as well who want to develop similar systems. So the key thing there that you saw was not only the detection of the fall, but also that automated dialogue. So what we want to do is to allow the person to still maintain some autonomy over their health and their wellness and the decisions being made and their information being sent out of the house. So through this conversation that we have with the person, this essentially allows that person, if they're able to make that decision for themselves. Now, if there's no response, the system would default and call the live operator at Lifeline or whatever call center that this system may be hooked up with. And the use of the speech recognition also had kind of this business aspect to it as well from Lifeline, where they want us to reduce the number of false alarms to the call. So as Tony mentioned, there's a high percentage of false alarms that go to these call operators, take them a lot of their time away from perhaps potential real emergency responses that they need to be dealing with. The final project I'm going to show you is something that's brand new. We're about 6 months into it, and this is around the issue of automated balance assessments. And a big problem, obviously, with older adults, as we mentioned, are falls. And furthermore, is getting them assessed to see who is actually going to be at risk for falling or not. And so typically what happens now is they'd go into a clinic, they would see their PT or their OT, who would do a series of different balance assessments, such as the Berg Balance Scale. Is anyone familiar with the Berg Balance Scale? Somewhat? So some people are. So the Berg Balance is a series of various motions and actions that the person does, for example, getting out of a chair. And then the PT or the OT assesses them and says, okay, well, you may be at risk of falling or not, and perhaps we'll then put them on an exercise program. So what we want to do is actually automate this assessment. And the vision that we have is kind of having, again, using our small webcams in the home, we can do things by just watching them get out of a chair, for example, or walking down the hallway every day, and we can assess their gait, we can assess their balance each and every day and make this assessment overall. And if the person then has changed in their gait or their patterns, we can then perhaps let the OT or the PT know that this person may be at an increased risk of falling. So what we're doing is actually developing low set, I promise no words, but I'm going to have a couple words on these slides, very few though. So what we want to do, as I said, is automate these assessments of these balance assessments. And we have key things that we want to make sure we do. They have to be low in cost, unobtrusive, validated against expert opinions, which is key. We don't want our tools not to be validated at all. And then validated against stability analysis from higher cost systems. So that is, the motion analysis that we're doing with the webcams, as I'll show you, are they really tracking the person's motion accurately? So this is an example of us, again, no markers on the person, a single webcam. We are tracking the head position of a person as they're moving out of a chair. And what we can do is get this motion analysis here of the head bobbing, And what we're actually finding is that this slight postural sway that we're detecting just from tracking the head movement is actually correlating quite well with the assessment of an actual therapist as they go through the Berg balance scale. The other thing we're doing as well is we can do simple tracking of sit to stand. So what you saw, there are two different ways a person getting out of a chair, one where she's pushing with her arms, and then one where the person is just standing up without any use at all. And it's been shown in the literature by just looking at how a person gets themselves out of a chair, again, can correlate very well with if the person has a risk of falling. So what we're trying to do, again, is to track, again, using a very simple webcam, the motion of a person as they sit down in a chair, get back up, and get these motion statistics. So again, no markers on the person. This is based on a simple, actually, two webcams, which are actually three webcams, I apologize, which is giving us 3D reconstruction of the person moving in their different limb segments. And my computer just crashed. Apparently, it doesn't want me to give the rest of this presentation. But that was actually the last slide. So at this point, then I'm going to hand it back to Tony to take us into the discussion.
People have been really, really diligent in following the guidelines, and we have time to have questions. So, it bailed on. So, questions for anyone on the panel?
So the first question was in terms of the fall detection, detecting different types of falls, essentially, and then also the changes in the environment, changing placement of furniture, et cetera. So the system currently right now has been developed to work with two types of falls, and that's kind of the sprawled out fall on the floor and then kind of the one into the fetal position where the person would essentially be perhaps in pain or hunched over. Now, in terms of if the person falls kind of over a table or something, at this point the system cannot work with that type of fall at this particular aspect just because the model I showed you is all based on 2D images only. So there's no 3D, there's no stereo information being provided to the camera at this point. We're working on that next phase. The hope, though, is that through the use of the speech recognition, which works into also sound recognition, is that perhaps we won't detect the person hunched over in pain, but we may hear them in pain, and the system will be activated that way as well. So we're going to use that second modality in addition. In terms of changes in the environment, what happens right now, and that video didn't show it, is we can actually manually annotate at this point the environment around the person. So we can say, okay, this is a chair, and the system will learn the features of the chair and be able to track if it moved around, or it may learn the features of the bed. And the main reason we do that is for the changes in the environment, but also for the learning of the long-term pattern. So we know, okay, the person's in the bed, they're sleeping, there's not a fall, or the person's sitting in their chair, and it would start recording the times for that. We're working on some new techniques right now on some machine learning techniques so it can learn the features automatically based on their activities and their levels of activity. Okay, that most likely this is the bed, this is the chair, or whatever else, so we don't have to go through and manually annotate that. The second question was, sorry? All the different types of chairs, Yeah, so the second question was on the balance assessment, how do we do with different types of chairs and stuff? We have not dealt with that yet, but that's something that we are thinking about in terms of learning the cushion heights, the different type of chair, and how we're going to learn those different features, again, through perhaps some machine learning techniques, or again, that may just be manually annotated, that we know, okay, the person's favorite chair is of this dimension, has this type of cushion, and that would just get pre-programmed as a priori data into the system itself. But it's kind of on the list of things to do for that particular project.
Yes, so the tasks are not limited to... Oh, sorry. The question is whether we had plans to expand IQ into a work environment, and absolutely the tasks are all defined by the therapist or other caregiver, so they could just as easily be vocational tasks as home tasks as far as the basic system goes, and then when you integrate sensors, it could be in a smart home or it could be in a smart work site. And the one virtual job coach I showed is being designed for a fast food setting.
Thank you. The question's about the MD2, that e-pill product that dispenses medications. If you go to their website, they spend a lot of time explaining how that's set up, but it can dispense medicine up to 20 times a day, and each medicine's in a little packet. So the caregiver has to set that up. Typically, you'd set it up for a month ahead of time. It can dispense one pill a day. It can dispense 20 pills 20 times a day. So the person who's taking the pill never has to pay attention to anything except, I have to take what's in that packet right now. Does that help? Yeah. It comes in, you put them in a little container, and that pops out of the slot. Okay?
We have time for a couple more.
So the question was, what happens if the person starts talking before the system actually asks the person the question? So that's in our new version, which I didn't show here, which has the barge-in capabilities. So essentially, like when you call the automated telephone operator, you can barge in. Before the person finishes the question, you can say what you want, and it'll recognize it. So the next version has the barge-in capabilities. The next version as well is not just going to rely on the yes and no. It's going to be more of a natural language system. The main reason why we want the yes and no at this point was, one, just to get the prototype up and running and kind of proof of concept, but also the questions that are being asked are actually right out of the training manual that's used by the call center operators. So we try to follow that as much as possible, and they try to elicit yes and no questions as much as possible as well. But we recognize if the person is panicked and in distress, they're not going to sit there and say yes, no, you know. They're going to say, like, give me a freaking ambulance here as soon as possible, right? So. And that's what our new speech corpus that we're developing, the database, is going to help us do as well, to recognize these key phrases. And just to mention very quickly, the way we're also developing that database is we're doing a complete contextual analysis or a thematic analysis of scripts and transcripts that we've taken from actual Lifeline calls, as well as calls to paramedics and 911. And we're going through and seeing the common phrases and words that are actually used by older adults in these situations. And those would be the words that we're going to train the system on, or the phrases that we're going to train the system on.
We probably have time for one more question, but before I do that, Anita's telling me the number is 574 for this course. Okay. Another question?
Yes, sir.
So just to see if I'm clear, the question is, so essentially what I was saying, the systems learn about the person, their patterns and their habits. What if the person has that abnormal pattern or habit that perhaps is not the correct thing? Is that what So the system learns about the person, but within the confines of the correct way of accomplishing the goal. So, for example, in the hand washing, the system knows, okay, what the system needs to achieve is get the person from point A to point F, or whatever our goal point is, in order to successfully complete hand washing. They also need to complete all these certain steps in a particular order, or various adaptations of that order. So the system would allow the person to be flexible in their preferences and the way they want to do something, as long as they're still reaching that overall goal successfully. Now, in terms of time and things like that, We there is a timeout feature that the system learns based on the person's past history, but time and getting the person through the task as quick as possible is not the goal of the system itself. We don't care if the person takes 8 minutes or 10 minutes to wash their hands. If that's typically what they do and they feel comfortable with, as long as they wash their hands or use the toilet properly and their caregiver is okay with it, then, you know, it doesn't really matter to us, the timing issue. But, yeah, so the system will not learn the abnormal patterns if it's detrimental to the overall goal or task being completed.
If I could ask one last question to the panel myself, can you estimate how long to market this translation might be for any of these products?
Well, it depends, Tony. I think one of the things has to do with the researchers themselves, and you know, Alex did a good example of saying, well, we're already working with Lifeline. I think some of our RERC projects are a good example where we actually started with a company in mind. You know, clearly Ed has his own company. So in large part, it's how we structure these tasks and how we structure our research and development and how quickly we get up and running with the process with manufacturers. And also there's a supply-demand issue. How necessary is this product? And is somebody willing to pay for it? And all those things tie in together with the whole tech transfer process. So we have kind of made a commitment to move as quickly as we possibly can within our RERC and what we're doing, and I think these guys have too.
Yeah, I can, the coach system, the prompting is probably a little bit away. The fall detection system I showed you, actually we just filed the patent on that, and we're getting ready, you know, getting our commercial partner up line as well. So I think the fall detection actually become a product within the next year or two for sure. That's our closest one. And then our new stuff is still ways away. In terms of our outcome, this overall vision of this intelligent home, you know, this is not going to happen tomorrow or the next 5 years. You know, this is something I think it's 10, 15, 20 years even down the road before we kind of achieve this goal and make it, you know, actually a reality. So
I would estimate that a lot of what I talked about, given an optimistic but realistic assessment of funding, is probably about 3 years out. Some of it, you know, probably a little further out than that.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for sitting through our talk. If you did not get a handout, please email me and I'll get one to you. Thank you.